Welcome everyone to our October roundtable guest expert Q&A with Dr. Jane Kesey. Jane is the author of more than two dozen books, including Holistic Leadership, Thriving Schools, 12 Lenses to Balance Priorities and Serve the Whole Student, which we are here to talk about today. So Jane, welcome to the roundtable.
Thank you. It's really good to be here.
Well, I'm excited to dig in deep because we've talked about this book on the podcast, Principal Center Radio. We've talked probably in person a few times and certainly many times for podcasts and things like that. Let's just jump right in to the work you do with polarities. What are some of the situations that organizations find themselves in that you see through a polarity lens? And then after framing that, we can get into exactly what a polarity is and how they can help us see those situations.
You know, there's seldom a situation that I'm called into for strategic planning or for perhaps getting a team to gel better or implementation of a new initiative where there's not a polarity involved. Especially, you know, one of the ways you can know that there's a polarity is if the same issue's been discussed over and over and a decision's been made and something's been implemented and things don't go well and all of a sudden you can see the pendulum swinging back toward what the other side wanted and they get their way and pretty soon it comes back over to the other side because that didn't work. So if you know, think of whole language versus phonics. Think of the fact that we've been in communities of critical friends and other kinds of teams and now we have professional learning communities. And you know, what's happened is we've gone too far to the community and need to go back toward the individual. But of course, individuals need teams and teams need to let individuals flourish. And I could keep talking without breathing because that's what goes on if we don't recognize that a polarity is there.
Yeah, absolutely. Those pendulum swings that we see affecting the entire profession, you know, around math instruction, reading instruction, whole child, child as data, you know, all of these different pendulum swings that we see across the profession. But we also see them within specific organizations. Yes. And I think some of the most hard to discern polarities are around human needs. Those needs that people have that are surfaced when big change efforts are underway, big reforms, hard work, grueling work, work with a big learning curve. What are some of the polarities that you help? I know you work directly with many schools and coach leaders through polarities. What are some of the kind of human polarities that we have to be mindful of as organizational leaders?
Let me tell a story to very much illustrate. I was working with a curriculum team a few weeks ago that's in the middle of a huge shift in how the district is supposed to be looking at learning. Much more student-centered, much more driven by innovation. And they've got this great vision. They've got great graphics around it. The superintendent is the marvelous communicator. And the teachers are complaining that they don't know what to do. That, you know, where's the meat of this? This is just going to be the same old thing again. And the grumbling started. And as we really worked through actually 2 days of workshop, the polarity that we finally centered on is clarity and flexibility. And for years, this district has given tons of flexibility to teachers to the point that when I said, well, can't you go back to your, you know, articulated curriculum, you know, through the grade level so that they can see what's staying the same? They said, we don't really have one. There's one that's, you know, we started it and never went further. And all of a sudden, I got to sit back because they realized that they were being so flexible that no one was clear on what was really supposed to go on and that they needed. There's a lot of creative people out there that see giving specific examples or giving more step by step. They feel like they're straitjacketing everybody. And they have to realize that you can give some clarity. You can say, hey, we're going to have everybody do A, B, and C, but you've got many ways to do it, or D, E, and F are going to be how you want to do it. So you can be flexible at the same time that you're clear, and you can delineate what's going on. And if you're clear without flexibility, you get implementation, you just get compliance. You lose the creativity. People just give up and follow the rote things that you're telling them to do. And we've seen that. But if you're too flexible, you lose everyone because they're scattered all over the place. You know, they're not shooting for the same star. And so you only have to be a little bit off trajectory with the rocket to go totally the wrong way once you get out of Earth's orbit. And that's what had been happening. So if you don't get those working together, you know, that clear direction and then flexibility that takes account for what happens in every classroom and the differences in students and the different strengths of teachers, either way, you'll get the downside of both and the initiative won't move forward. And, you know, and once they got that, I got to sit back while they just strategized. And it's a wonderful thing to just add a comment and watch them learn from how they got where they are and then come up with the real action steps to move forward.
Yeah, well, it's almost like it gives people permission to, you know, to respect the other side without giving up theirs. You know, if this has been a loggerheads situation, it's so freeing to know that, okay, you're right, but also the other people have a valid point and there's a way that those can be managed and work together without having a winner and a loser because both matter. So I think that's probably a good opportunity to get into exactly what a polarity is. Because it's not quite the same as a dichotomy. It's not, you know, like we talk a lot about best practice, like this is best practice, that is not. And we are as leaders responsible for making sure that best practice happens and that not best practice does not happen. But a polarity lens is very different. And I think the you know, just the way that they're managed is a little bit counterintuitive because we're, you know, we're used to fighting, right? We're used to advocating for our position and winning. So take us into that, you know, the kind of butterfly aspect of how those work.
Well, you know, first, the simple definition is polarities are interdependent sets of values that over time need each other. So, you know, I was talking to a school leader yesterday and she has little children. And I said, you know, I bet your children have things that everybody shares, you know, the Lego pieces or whatever it is. And there's probably a few precious things that each child does not have to share. And that's a polarity. You know, what's mine and what's everyone's? You know, we've been managing polarities our whole lives and they're interdependent. You know, if a child doesn't feel ownership, then in a sense, they don't understand how precious it is to share, you know. You know, we learn from sharing, we learn from having our own things, and there's an interdependency. And you need to think of polarities not as two sides, but as an infinity loop. They're systems. And so often I can listen to a leader talk about what's going wrong. These teachers, they don't have a creative bone in their body. I can't get them to do anything. I need a new staff. And that gives me a clue right away that she's asking for something that they don't understand. And I'll go talk to the teachers and I'll hear, she isn't a leader. She isn't showing us what to do. She's expecting us to come up. Someone has done this before and we shouldn't be creating things out of nothing. And you can hear the fears and you can hear the values. And we get so entrenched in our own side, just as the example I talked about with the, you know, everyone saying, oh, we don't want to tell them what to do, that they don't see the downside of their own position. And so they get into this infighting. And when we do what we call polarity mapping and the group together figures out what's valuable about each side and what goes wrong if you over-focus on either side. So it's a very different language because we're not talking about what's wrong with the other side. We're saying, if I pay too much attention to it, then I'm going to miss the benefits of one. And that ends up being a problem.
Right. So in the infinity loop diagram, you know, we've got our two perspectives in the polarity, our two issues that are in healthy tension, necessary tension with one another, and each has both an upside and a downside. And we get the upside of both if we manage it well, but if we overemphasize one, we start to get the downsides of that, or get the, you know, like how do people get caught in the downsides and move out of them? Because I recall some kind of conceptual moves that people can make when they get caught into the downsides. Refresh my memory on that.
Yeah, let's just take an easy example, and I mean, we could all hold our breath here. You know, just take a deep breath and think about holding it and holding it and holding it and holding it. And if we hold it long enough and I ask you which is better, exhaling or inhaling, people always say actually exhaling is better than inhaling. Well, if you exhale and exhale and exhale, you're going to faint. And breathing is a good example because we all work with it. We've been working with it since we took our first breath. And most of the time we don't think about it. But when, you know, Justin, you can tell me quickly, when do we consciously have to think about our breathing, how fast we're breathing, how deep we're breathing?
I mean, really only when there's a problem, right? Like when we're out of air.
Well, when we're exercising, we're singing, when we're, trying to hold our temper in a meeting, perhaps you might do the three deep breaths before I say anything technique. And we've all run out of breath. We're so, you know, we might be focused on something else and all of a sudden we realize we've lost track of it, or we're holding our breath underwater and all of a sudden, you know, we realize we've really got to breathe quickly. You know, there's all kinds of ways we run out of breath. The point is we get so entrenched in our own peace. I think of the whole language versus phonics debate, or you could look at algorithms in mathematics and open problem solving in mathematics. Or, you know, direct instruction, guided inquiry. These are all polarities. And we get so fired up about what we're trying to move to because we see the dangers and what's going on that we don't see our own downside. It's human nature it's really quick to see the negatives of what we don't believe in. And it's really hard to see the negatives of what we're so fired up about. And that's where, you know, bringing people together to say both sides are right. Actually, that's incorrect. Both sides hold part of the truth. And if we come together, we'll get the whole truth. If we stay apart, we're going to keep the pendulum swings going.
Yeah, absolutely. And those pendulum swings often have a huge price tag attached to them, right? We spend money to do one thing, and then we realize we've overemphasized that. So we spend money to do the opposite. And staff is just kind of going like this, like they're watching the pendulum swing. And we're undoing our own work, you know, in slow motion sometimes. And one tendency that that I've seen a lot among people who become district administrators, you know, people who are fairly hard driving, you know, care a great deal about you know, student learning, is this tension. I think you probably have several that would fit under this category, but of you know, of pushing forward, of pushing for change, of you know, wanting to drive people forward and having that kind of healthy impatience. And I know I've spoken with several people about this. Like in chapter 9, you have the polarity moving ahead quickly and moving ahead for the long haul. And in chapter 11, you have getting results and building trust. And chapter 13, having clarity on what and why, and having flexibility on how. So like almost all of those would fit this tension that I see, especially for the kind of people who end up, I'm thinking of some very specific people who are here on this live call, you know, people who really do want to move people forward and feel like there's a moral obligation to not allow the past, the practices of 50 years ago to dominate in today's classrooms when we have students' needs that are not being met. Heather says, I figured those chapters were written for me. Take us into that, because I think for senior leaders, especially who need to drive the urgency for their organization. Now, if you have lots and lots of people who are content to keep doing what they've been doing, and you know it is kind of on you as a leader to not allow complacency to rule forever, what are some things we need to think about if that's, you know, if that's who we are and the role that we play in our organizations?
Well, I think one thing to think about is the fact that leadership is really, really complex. And often we're not given the tools to lead, we're given the tools to manage. And you know, and I just, this book, there's a couple books by a woman named Jennifer Garby Berger that are about adult development as well as about leadership. And one of the things she says is, if you can't hold these kinds of things, you know, if you want to develop as an adult and get past either needing to have your own way or needing approval, which we do in different ways healthily, then you need to learn to look both directions at once. And that's polarity thinking. So this is actually a tool for developing as an adult, becoming more wise, becoming more mature. And it's really difficult when you're driving toward change to keep these tensions in mind. So what often happens is the leader's charged with outcomes, which is one pole. And they're looking at, I have to get more students, you know, to graduate or to achieve in math or to be engaged in the classroom, whatever it is in your particular school situation. And they forget that before you can really drive people toward change, you have to have trust in the room. You have to have that collaboration. We know that the number one predictor actually of student outcomes is collective teacher efficacy, where they trust each other. They not only have a common vision, but they believe their hard work will move them toward their vision. So if you've got, you know, you set out the outcomes, we're going to increase reading scores by blank or whatever it is. And the teachers are going, they might even catch the vision. I'm going to assume you're great at conveying it. And yet, as if they start working on it and they start getting discouraged, they all of a sudden they say, we've done this before. We did reading recovery. We adapted, you know, 4 years ago, we adopted a new reading curriculum. That didn't help. We did this and that didn't help. All of a sudden, your efficacy starts going down. And if the leader keeps pushing on outcomes and forgets about the people, which is the other pole, you can't get outcomes unless the people are on board, which is the relationships, building the trust, building the collaborative skills, which are not naturally human characteristics, especially for teachers who've been working alone in their classrooms. You'll lose track of the outcomes. You'll lose both. You won't get the outcomes and you'll have a disengaged staff, which 2/3 of our teachers in America say they're not engaged. So the good news is that's the same statistic as corporate America, but I don't think it's very good when we're talking about the outcomes of our students. So you know, you can think of it as you're so driven on one thing that you forget that it has to be supported by something else. You can be, another thing that happens so commonly is that they're so focused on the vision that, and you know, you might get lines like, come on, we put a man on the moon in under a decade. With the attitude we've got to have toward our students, we can do this. We can take the graduation rate to 100%. And they forget the realities, you know, that schools aren't in charge of everything, that there is limited time and we're human beings, not human doings. We will burn out. And that the resources have to be allocated, or they'll, you know, that's reality. We don't get stuck in reality and say we can't. But if we've got a vision that actually outpaces reality, if we don't realize that our vision requires the same kind of infrastructure changes that NASA made with billions spent on the biggest buildings ever built to house those rockets and, you know, exponential growth in staffing to carry out that that mission, then the reality isn't being held, accounted for, and you'll get the downside of both. You'll get stuck in a spiraling down reality because people are so demotivated, and they won't reach their vision. So what do we need to do? We need to have a healthy sense of what can really be done. We can't have too many initiatives because that's actually abdicating responsibility because they won't all get done. They just won't. And so the leader doesn't even know what's falling off of everyone's plates in reality. And so how do you fix this? You actually have to sit down and say, you know, what are the things we need to pay attention to in reality? What's key about our vision and what action steps do we need to take to keep both of those going? And what you end up with is a real-time strategic plan that you adjust. Every time the pendulum starts to get a little bit too far over, you go, uh-oh, people are, you know, they're starting to gripe about the realities and they're losing track of this exciting vision. I need to pump them up again. But I also need to take a look at how much overtime is being put in and whether there's cracks starting to form and how much efficacy people feel so that I get the balance going again. Because that's the only way we're going to move forward.
Yeah, very well said. And it reminds me of the definition of being decisive, right? Like sometimes we think being decisive is just going all in on something. But I don't know the exact Latin roots, but I know, you know, being decisive shares a common root with the word for deciduous trees, you know, trees that drop their leaves. And I think sometimes we have to really stop and acknowledge that if we are going to be decisive about one issue, we are going to have to kind of cut off other options. Like other leaves are going to have to fall from the tree in order for us to pursue a particular direction without swinging that pendulum and, you know, overtaxing people, overwhelming people, and demanding things of people that we have not built the capacity for. So I appreciate that emphasis on reality. Like we don't really like to talk about reality very much because it seems like we're supposed to be shapers of reality. But we do run into that at some point, don't we?
You know, I love using children's stories to illustrate things and get people going because they're short and pithy. And so last week with the gifted ed coordinators, I used Charlotte's Web, There's this great scene in Charlotte's Web where Wilbur the pig has just learned what happens to pigs that farmers are fattening. The old sheep has said, yeah, you know, the farmer's going to come in here with a shotgun. And, you know, Wilbur just starts screaming because has human characteristics in the story and doesn't want to die. And he's, you know, the sheep is like, would you shut up? And all of a sudden the little voice, you know, comes over Wilbur's, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And Charlotte says, don't worry, I'll save you. And, you know, Wilbur, you know, a little later says, are you really going to save me? And Charlotte says, yes. How? That's what I'm working on, Wilbur. And so the group mapped, what are Charlotte's realities as a spider? I mean, she's this tiny little creature stuck up in a web, and yet she knows her skills. She knows how to weave a web, that her web can be an asset. And, you know, so the group together came up with all those things. What would happen if Charlotte overfocused on her realities? Well, there's no way she can save a pig. You know, she can't influence the farmer. How's she going to have a voice? The farmer doesn't hear her. Only the farmer's daughter can hear the animals talk, right? So if she overfocuses on it, she's going to lose that vision of saving Wilbur and having that influence. But if she overfocuses on that, she's actually going to lose the pieces. You know, she's going to get caught up in the dreaming and the planning and not get real about what she can do. Like, she needs partners. She actually convinces Templeton the rat, you know, to go and find words that she can put into the web and to help them get to the fair and all these different things. So, you know, what I was trying to illustrate with the group is, as a gifted ed coordinator, you can get stuck in the reality of, oh, I don't have positional power. Oh, the teachers see this as breaking up the community in their classroom if I pull students out, but I have such a hard time finding time to coach the teachers and differentiation and all those things that go on. And they forget that they're actually in charge of firing up the teachers with the vision of how gifted ed can help every child if it's done right, and why we have gifted education for the students who are just needing a little more beyond what would actually maybe be detrimental to the classroom. So, it, you know, then we really got into what does this mean in my class? But the whole point is, you know, when we play around with the idea in some form like that, then we can see what it means in our own situation.
Love it. Love it. So one of the things I'm trying to be more intentional about in my communication is seeing teacher leaders as instructional leaders, and making that charge to build capacity for instructional leadership not just something we do on our admin teams, and not just something that we personally develop ourselves to build capacity for instructional leadership. So thinking about polarities, Heather, I want to throw it over to your question that you've asked here in the chat, and frame it a question around getting teachers to understand polarities. Because certainly this is a useful tool for us to think about in our work. But Heather, I love that about really explaining this to teachers and getting teachers to take on some of that. So Heather, if you want to unmute and turn your webcam on and set that up for us, I'd love to hear from you and some of your thoughts.
Hi there. Thanks, Justin. Thank you for all of this, Jane. It's fascinating and super practical. As I've read through the book, I realize there's lots of great detailed processes for me as a leader to start to prioritize which values, which lenses, what steps, action steps. What suggestions do you have for working through a process with a group of teachers, say a core leadership team, or perhaps a whole staff if it's a smaller school, in terms of helping them identify which lens we might need to work on as a group?
Well, there's a couple ways. You know, sometimes I start with really talking to a few leaders about what's going on, which is, you know, with the gifted educators that I was talking about. I was talking about the coordinator of the program. And so we thought that reality and vision. And then the other one we looked at was, what do they have the power to do on their own in their position, positional power? And what do they need collaborative power for, power with? And especially since it shouldn't be a gendered issue, but most gifted ed coordinators are women, and women tend to see power as power over. We started with, no. Power is not always abusive. You know, you have, in your position as gifted ed coordinator, the power to get everybody excited about gifted ed and what's the, you know, conveying that vision, however you collectively put that together with the school or district leadership, you have the power to do that. But you can't carry it out without collaborating with all the teachers. And that actually gave them permission to think of themselves more as leaders. So, you know, I mean, that even on your professional learning community teams, that can be powerful, as you know, teachers often don't see themselves as leaders, and helping them see that you're doing both of those. You know, if you've had something great happen in your classroom and you can articulate that to your PLC, you're not setting yourself above them. You're not trying to grab any power. You're trying to collaborate to get everybody moving in the same direction if it's done right. So, you know, if I were thinking about how to introduce this to my teaching staff, you know, we might start on page 19, where we've got this little chart that has 12 key polarities that school leaders deal with, and tiny little definitions that are expanded in each of the chapters. And I might just go through these and say, which of these speaks to our situation? Which is, you know, if I'm not starting from scratch, if I've got the leaders to talk to, often we can nail one that will at least start the conversation. You know, as I was working with the curriculum team that I mentioned, we actually identified 5 or 6 that, I mean, there's only 12 in the book. And, you know, we saw that 5 or 6 might be pertinent, because it's a big situation when you're, you know, putting out a whole new district strategic plan. And actually, they may all be key. And if, you know, if they hired me to actually work with them over the course of the year, we could measure where they are on those 5 or 6 polarities with a validated instrument and know from the ranks how people are really feeling about, do we have enough direction? Do we have the trust we need? Is the leadership listening to us? Do we, are we seeing our role as collaborative teams, or is it all feeling like it's coming from the top? We would actually know that and then be able to put our action steps together accordingly. So, but on a smaller level, you can pick, you know, one and play with it. Maybe, as I frequently do with a fictional story or a little scenario that's not quite so close to home. You know, I call it taking it out of the workplace. So we're talking about planning picnics, or we're talking about, you know, being on a volunteer board together, you know, something where people just feel a little safer to say, well, I'd never do this as a school principal, but if we were choosing teams for kickball, let's be honest about how I'd do this. And, you know, so people can play with it. And often there's that moment where everybody goes, oh my gosh, we have fought this battle so many times, and there shouldn't be any battle. It should just, we should be talking about these values and fears, and then you can go forward. So in other words, I say, start with something either less threatening or actually fictional. And I've got all, I mean, I've used Pippi Longstocking. I've used Frog and Toad. I've used Touching Spirit Bear and Loser and all kinds of books to find these little scenarios that people can play with and have fun with. And it really helps people open up to this idea that both sides hold part of the truth.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heather, very much for asking that question, and feel free to jump back in. And anyone else who is with us, let me know in the chat if you'd like me to make you a panelist, and you can ask your question that way or just in the chat. So I'll be keeping an eye on that. Jane, I wanted to ask a kind of a follow-up question based on Heather's question around collecting data about people's perceptions. So if I, as a leader, have a sense that people in my organization are engaging in outdated practices, they're dragging their feet on change, we're living in the 20th century, you know, that's the reality in our organization, that the practices are just very outdated, very traditional, and I'm really, really, really trying to get people to move along. How can I get a sense of what other people's perception is? How can I collect data? Like, if I've got this polarity map, and I think we're getting all the downsides of continuity and none of the upsides of change, you know, I feel the urgency, I feel the drive to move forward with our strategic priorities. But I want to know, do other people see it that way? Are they reading this situation the same way I am? And what do they perceive that's different from my perceptions? How can we collect data on that from our staff?
So I love how you phrase that, the continuity and change, because we, when we're working with polarities, we always find the positive ways of talking about both sides. So people aren't stuck in the past. People are very aware that if some things don't continue and we try and change everything, we're going to get a mess. You know, you can't change everything at once. Not only that, but there's value in what we're doing. And in one district, one of the things that the teachers voiced was, when you say we've got a whole new vision, you're telling us that everything we did in the past was terrible. And A, our test results don't show that. And B, that's not very motivating. and they had to back up and label what was continuing, because there were so many great things that this particular district had done. So continuity and change, not stuck in the past or refusing to change or resisting. As a matter of fact, listening to the resistors actually is data, and figuring out what they're saying actually expresses their fears for your side of the polarity that you're not seeing. And there is a truth when people say, but we don't have time to do this. You know, find out how much time they're going to take, they think it's going to take, and see if it's being allocated. I can't tell you how many initiatives, you know, we know how much training time it takes, and it's not built into the schedule. The teachers are right. They are not going to have enough knowledge to pull off what's going on, especially in math initiatives. You know, the curriculum's changed, and yet the teachers aren't given the skills they need to use the new curriculum, which in many cases takes more knowledge of basic math than perhaps they got in the algorithmic way they were taught. So that's the continuity and change piece is so important to think about. On the data side, there's a couple ways. We had one, I had one school where the principal and the reading specialist had been emphasizing allowing free reading time and with students choosing their materials, which is a research-based strategy that actually shows as much or more progress in reading scores than any curriculum or other intervention. Maybe not, you know, there's others that do just as well, but it shouldn't be a surprise that letting children read things that are motivating for them to read actually helps them learn how to read. Because Justin, you go home and read things you hate every night, right? For fun, right? To make yourself miserable. So we simply pulled the staff together who were not implementing free reading time. They weren't doing it. And I can't remember quite off the top of my head how we set it up. We actually mapped, what do you value about the structured curriculum that you're using? And what downside do you see? What's value about letting children read for choice? And what's the downside of letting children read for choice? And, you know, there were 30 or 40 teachers, so we broke them into small groups so that they were each mapping. And then we looked, and when you map, you write, you actually have, you know, four stations, and you're writing, you know, what's valuable about this poll on at one station, what are the fears at another, you know, and the third and fourth are the values and fears of the other. When we got done with all the maps, the themes that came out were, it's so easy to collaborate when we're using the standardized curriculum, was one of the big values. They also valued that it was easy to assess the skills they were being held accountable for teaching the students for. They weren't really aware. It was really only the reading specialist and the principal that pointed out that children were seeing reading as work. That they were saying, why would I read over the summer? That's just doing homework during my free time. The teachers weren't seeing that because when they talked about free reading, the teachers didn't have a whole lot to say about the value of it. But of course, the principal and the reading specialist were saying, you know, they're motivated. Children can be book sharing and get that excitement going. We can teach concepts with multiple character examples and all those sorts of things. And they weren't really seeing the downside. The teacher's downside, what came out was they're afraid the children would read nothing but Garfield. And this also happened to be a staff, for whatever reason, they weren't reading grade level materials. They didn't know what the great books were at the grade levels they were teaching. So how can you be excited to recommend and guide free reading for students when you don't know what to recommend? So all the work that, this was in January. So when they called me in, September through January, they'd been just giving strategies for using free reading to teach skills. That's all they'd been doing. And of course, that's not what the teachers needed at all. They needed You know, I won't even go into that, but you can't move them forward unless they know what the grade level materials were. They would have been better off using drop everything and read with the staff during professional development and getting staff to just read things, but they didn't know that was the problem. So one way you can do it is to just pull the stakeholders together, make sure you set it up so that nobody's, you know, guard is going to go up. You know, in this case, the way the questions were phrased, they were free. They knew from the bat, from the start, that they were going to get to discs, free reading. You know, they were going to have their say, and that opened them up to doing it. And they changed the whole professional development for the rest of the year after that. There is a formal way to do it. So when the teacher accountability systems were being rolled out a few years ago, I got one district to use the form, or the one district asked to use the formal system, and we sent it's a survey that has what you might call parallel questions for the four quadrants, looking at the values and fears, and people rated in terms of how often they see this happening. And we can aggregate the data, and we can also show it by different, or disaggregate it. So we knew what the instructional coaches were saying, we knew what the administrators were saying, and we knew what the evaluators were saying. And on a couple of the questions, for example, the evaluator said, we're identifying the teachers who need the most support. They strongly agreed with that. The coaches said, no, we're not. The coaches vehemently disagreed with that statement, if I might use that language. I think it was actually seldom. But, you know, if you look at the bar chart, there was just this huge gap. And there were gaps like that on several other questions. It doesn't matter who's right, if they're identifying the right teachers for support or not. The point is different groups are seeing this as incredibly effective or ineffective. And if they don't come together, we're going to get the downside because their heart won't be in it, or their skill set won't, or it really will be the wrong teachers coming forward, or the coaches won't think they're coaching the right teachers and therefore not do it well. So they had real data to make those changes. We had another really simple one with the idea that students can retake tests to show mastery of standards. And in group sessions, long story short, in the group sessions, the squeaky wheels were saying, this is messing up our curriculum pacing, this is taking too long, blah, blah, blah. When we got the actual data, that's not what came forward. What came forward actually is that students were taking less responsibility. They were like, especially the advanced placement students, smart people that they are, you know, good students that they are, would take the test, figure out what they were going to have to study for, and be really willing then to come in and do a good job on a retake, which took up teacher time, which took up other things. And so when we got all that, I said, this is easy to solve. You know, the retakes are at 6 a.m. and, you know, the students are going to be really motivated to do well the first time. You know, maybe we need a better study guide so that they understand that, you know, the guy, the, what does Jim Knight call them? The, you know, the overview of a unit so the students know what's important. There's all kinds of ways to solve this so that we get the right balance of student responsibility for progress and teacher responsibility for progress. So that's a long answer. That's three ways to get data.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So if I can kind of recap here. So you're saying just to get a sense of what the pros and cons of both poll are, you can divide your group into four groups, go to four stations and say, okay, what are the pros of this one? And then another group, what are the cons? And then what are the pros of the other poll? What are the cons of the other poll? And just have each group rotate through all four and just brainstorm, just list on a chart, you know, on a piece of chart paper, or on a whiteboard, what are the pros or cons, whichever station you're at, and get that list. And then you describe the process of collecting data by role and saying, okay, we have to disaggregate this. What is the administrator's perspective? What are the coach's perspective? What are the teacher's perspective? And I'm envisioning, we didn't talk about, you know, the specifics of how to do that, but I'm envisioning like kind of a Likert scale survey that says, okay, what's your role? Pick your role. And then how strongly do you agree or disagree with each of those key pros and cons that were identified? So if there, let's say there are four pros and four cons for each poll, we could ask about, and jump in here and correct me if I'm wrong, but you could ask about each of those, you know, do you agree that this is happening? Do you agree, you know, disagree that this is happening? And you can see the difference in the perceptions between leaders, between, you know, frontline teachers and teacher leaders and coaches in the middle, that could really, I don't know, do you see schools using that, or how would you recommend that schools collect that data? Once we've figured out what the pros and cons are and what the upsides and downsides are, to figure out where we are as an organization on that map, what do you think?
You know, schools have been so focused on objective outcome-based data for academic achievement that they've underutilized other forms of data, and this is one. What I can say is when I've gotten a school to use it, we've seen amazing cost savings or amazing changes in attitude because people know it's the truth. So another school, this is a school where all the children are above average, and I'm not kidding. You know, the 98% go on to four-year institutions. And I've also seen some of the, I won't say it just in case anybody figures out where I am, but so I was working with seventh grade teachers, and they did have honors classes and regulars classes at the school. And we surveyed the students on how rigorous they thought the teaching was and what they were learning was. And what came back was in the honors class, there was a high percentage of students that said, I can get good grades without working very hard. And the teachers really thought that they had upped the rigor in those classes, and they'd been resistant to what I would call higher level thinking strategies because they thought they were already doing it, and they weren't, and the students knew it. And I've never had coaching appointments set up so quickly. They were so motivated once they'd heard the students actually say, you know, through a survey, I don't have to work hard for a grade at all. So, you know, getting this different kind of data can really change people's mindsets, because if you're good at teaching one way and it's the way you learn, which is how most of us teach, then it's very, very difficult to see that you've got to add something else that's going to actually make a bigger difference. And it's going to be a lot of work. It's going to pull you out of your strengths. You're going to need some scaffolding that helps you from losing all your energy to do that. And it's no wonder that people go, oh, that's not going to work. You know, that's not going to be good for students, or it's not necessary because we've already got this. So it was really pretty funny having people, call me in that afternoon saying, can you help me change this unit that I'm starting tomorrow? Not that I'm ever, you know, not allowed in, but the urgency was incredible because they'd seen the data.
You know, well, I think that's a great example of involving students in providing the data that we're looking at. Go ahead.
You know what I want to do? Do you remember down in when we were in that workshop in North Carolina? I want to see if I can find the slide of how we collected data by just putting markers down. Do you remember that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like dots on a dot, you know. Put a sticker dot, you know, tell us where you think we are.
We were all standing around the chart on the floor. Here it is. So I'm going to pull up all through. Well, let's see what else I want to do. I'm just looking for the one where we can really see it. I think this is it. Okay. So let me share my screen. Let me just make sure this is the best one. Sorry for the delay, but we just want to see where those markers are in the pictures. Okay, this one has probably the most. And we were looking at, academic achievement and whole child achievement when we were doing this. And we had a bunch of educators standing around. We had just mapped onto flip charts the values and fears. And then we asked everybody, you know, you put it down and you've got a, I'm sorry, I can't share because there's been upgrade to Mac systems and it's not talking to Zoom. I found that out last week. So I'll just have to describe it. We had, you know, when we do a full polarity map, we actually tape the floor. So we've got the names of the poles on each side. We've got a piece of tape running up the middle, and it's blue or green going toward the top and red going toward the bottom, as in danger, danger, Will Rogers. And so you've got that middle pole that you can use sort of as thinking about, am I moving toward what we call our greater purpose? With, if you're looking at academic achievement and whole child achievement, you're looking at all students being successful. And we'd want to define that more so that it's not just a glittering generality. But we actually just gave everybody one of the markers, because that's what we had, and said, where on the center line would you put your organization? And some people had it at neutral, and some people had it down and we're not balancing this at all, and a few had it a little bit farther up. So we just had this quick measurement. If you're doing it with the staff and confidentiality is a question, you can, you know, quickly make, just take a piece of chart paper and put it on the back of the door where no one can see where people are putting their own individual little, you know, round stickers, and have everybody put, how well are we balancing teaching algorithms and math and helping students think of like a mathematician, is another polarity that's standard. How well are we balancing the time we have as individuals to work on what we need to do for our classrooms and our parents and our students, and how much time do we have for collaborative activities that push forward student outcomes? How are we balancing that? And let people just mark it so that you've got this quick read. Are we okay? Are we in the green zone? Are we moving toward red? Is a really healthy thing to do.
Love it. Love it. I was thinking about that confidentiality and how, the first person who puts their sticker up, you know, really gets, you know, their own thinking on paper. But as we start to see other people's answers, maybe we start to move ours a little bit. So this would be a good use case for invisible ink, or, you know, write with the lemon juice and make it, you know, turn brown with the hairdryer so we can see it after everybody answers. But yeah, I think that perception data, as you said, is such an important kind of data. We're so focused on student learning data that often we have really no data about staff perceptions and the gap between the perceptions of leaders and the perceptions of everyone else. And that's, you know, I think as with many things in the polarity management world, it's data that can be a little bit intimidating. Like, we might not want to know that, but once we do know it and we come to grips with it, we're really, really glad we collected that data and made that discovery, rather than just have that be something we're not aware of.
And it's, you know, as in all data, if you collect it, you know, what I love about the polarity process is there's this idea of learning from how we got to where we are that I think is so often missing in strategic planning. So, you know, if you find out that the staff thinks we're over-focused on, inquiry in math versus teaching algorithms in math, you can sit there and say, okay, what have we done the last years that have gotten us here? Have we talked about the value of algorithms? Are they feeling like they can't teach the, I was in one school where the teachers were afraid to teach math facts. They thought that drilling students for automaticity was actually evil. And I heard the principal say that. So there was a reason they were worried about this. Well, you know, automaticity is what makes math fun. If you don't have to look up 8 times 7 or punch it into a calculator, that's when you can start playing with math ideas. And math should be as fun as art class, which is sort of not the attitude in the US. So, you know, that's data right there that you're out of balance if it's not. If students don't go, all right, it's time for math. Just backing up from that, you know, math facts with time tests are detrimental. We know that some students, you know, really get tied up in that. But there are a way to teach math facts for each personality of the students, which is another piece of work that I do, that has them actually looking forward to the day when they can go, oh, 5 times 8, I know what that is, and I don't have to look it up. And so seeing that, you know, memorization, the facts and or the content and the processes of a discipline, whether it's, you know, you don't have to know the date of every battle in the Civil War, but it is good to know that the Revolutionary War happened before the Civil War, and that Gettysburg was the turning point. And, some facts are a good idea. I just read Einstein's biography by Walter Isaacson, and Thomas Edison had a test that he thought every educated person should be able to pass as a sign that I don't know, I was supposed to be like a Mensa entry today or something like that. And it had things like how many feet are in a mile. And Einstein flunked it. And he said, why would I hold that knowledge in my head when I can look it up? And yet, of course, Einstein had incredible handling of many, many, mastery of many, many facts. But that tension, you know, this is one of the ways you know it's a polarity. There's 100 years right there that we've been arguing it. And it goes back way further than that. You know, Dickens did a parody of it in Hard Times where the schoolmaster said, this rug has flowers in it. This has to be removed from the school because flowers don't grow in floors. They grow in gardens, and this is a floor. So get this rug out of here. Our students need facts. You know, and it was a parody of, of course, Dickens was an idea guy. He was not a, but his books are based in facts, even as they made fun of things. So this has been going on forever. And how often in a school do we see the pendulum swing too far one way or the other? And I love Linda Darling Hammond's point that when we have these pendulum swings, and they're predictable, you know, my 2013 book on polarities laid out exactly what would happen with the Common Core if we didn't also take into account what needs to be customized. It's not because I'm a genius. It's because these are systems. You push on one side, you get the reaction on the other. But Darling Hammond says it's the schools with the least resources and the most disadvantaged students that learn the most, or that lose the most. The high-end schools, where whether that's the parent resources or the funding or whatever, they aren't hit as hard because they're already doing well. They don't make the big changes. They aren't forced to. And so a lot of them, you know, can keep teaching in their own way and keep getting the same great results. It's the poorest schools where these huge, expensive pendulum swings hurt students the most.
Yeah. I wanted to ask, Jane, what would be your most direct book on how to do polarity mapping? If you want to grab that and if it's within reach there and share it with us.
Funny thing, I have this little shelf, right? It's Unleashing the Positive Power of Differences, right, which came out from Corwin in 2013. And there's four, what I'd almost call literature review chapters. You know, there's one that lays out teacher responsibility and student responsibility, so you can just get a feel for how it works. And then we have, you know, I did a lit review of how the pendulum keeps swinging on academic success and whole child success, which is how we got into No Child Left Behind. There's one on holding teachers accountable and helping them grow. You can't help hold a first-year teacher accountable if you don't have the supports in place to help them master what's one of the most complex professions out there. There's one on standardization and customization in the Common Core. And then there's one on what we were just talking about with the knowledge of a discipline and the practices of a discipline. So those are, I tell people, read the one that speaks to you the most so you get the feel of this. You don't have to read them all, although that, honest, somebody stayed up all night reading those chapters. But then the next half of the book is, how do you do this? You know, how do you introduce it with your staff? And there's a literature example of how you can get them into it. And you can even go out to Corwin and download the slides to use. You know, it's all set up for you to do. And then there's chapters on how to dig in deeper, how to plan professional development. You know, you can sit down with your reading specialist and say, let's pre-guess what the values and fears are and plan accordingly. You know, let's make sure the first thing we do addresses what they're afraid of so that they're willing, you know, the first move that we're going to make in this PD has them saying, oh, maybe free reading would be good. And that you just disarm that natural resistance, not in a manipulative way, but because you're recognizing what's actually could go wrong if you overfocus on free reading and your PD is set up that way. And then there's a way to use it with students if you want them really being able to listen to both sides and develop a good argument. The research is that the smarter you are, the better you are at creating your one-sided argument. You are not necessarily going to look at both sides unless you're trained to do so, which I think we see quite easily in what plays out around us in our polarized world. So,
yeah. So Unleashing the Positive Power of Differences. So we have done a podcast on that. It's been a few years, but a really, really good and practical book on how to do polarity mapping. And one of the reasons that I think the newer book, Holistic Leadership, Thriving Schools, is especially useful in terms of building capacity for leadership. I know we have a lot of superintendents and assistant superintendents on this call who are thinking about leaders who may be new to a leadership role and thinking for the whole system, perhaps for the first time. I love the way that polarity management can help leaders prevent themselves from being blindsided. You know, and as you just said, going into a conversation, don't just go in with your perspective, but think, anticipate what are the other parties in the conversation going to see as the downsides of my perspective, or as what are their fears going to be? And for the things that I don't want right now that I'm not focused on, what are the values in the other person's perspective? Like, anticipate what goes in all four of those quadrants before the conversation. What advice do you have for superintendents, or further thoughts for district leaders who are supervising new leaders who maybe seem to be in a pattern of getting blindsided by these issues? They're driving hard on one thing, and then they're just thrown for a loop by the resistance, the pushback, the, you know, the responses of the people they're leading.
So, three things. I use this in the first course in the doctoral program that I'm part of, and these emerging leaders set a goal and walk through the holistic leadership process. And that holistic leadership process, point two, was designed to ensure that leadership development follows through with the five things that have to happen for a program to have an effect on actual leadership. I cannot find the stat again, but most leadership programs don't have an impact on how well people lead. And the report from McKinsey and Company, which is a big management firm, says you need to, it can't be a one and done. It's got to be situated in the work of leaders. So when I'm working with emerging leaders, they are looking at a real goal in the, that they are setting. And it's about schools. You know, I have a business version of holistic leadership too, because I happen to coach in both sides. I've been coaching, you know, I've been an executive coach for almost 30 years now. And a teacher is as much an executive as, you know, the head of, you know, some of the bigger companies I've worked with, because they're still in charge of what goes on with a group. So it has to be situated in their work. It can't be one-off. It has to be in the context of what they're doing right now. So we don't set a goal like be a better leader. We set a goal like ensuring everybody's got the vision for this particular initiative. Or I have one school superintendent right now whose goal is empowering one of his deputies and yet not relinquishing control. This guy is so nice that he does most things by democratic vote. And sometimes he needs to be in charge. So that's part of his development, even as a fantastic superintendent. The third thing is you have to tackle mindset. We are human beings entrenched in the patterns that have developed in our brains. And holistic leadership actually uses four tools to unlock mindset if you go through the whole process. And the fourth is you have to measure. And if you're measuring catching the vision or building trust or being more empathetic, SMART goals don't work very well. And we also want to remember that the research shows that when we set SMART goals, people usually under-challenge themselves and more cheating goes on. That's just what happens. So we're looking at development goals and targets. And so you know, all these things wrap together. Oh, and the fifth thing is it takes time. McKinsey didn't underline that, but you don't do leadership development in 20 minutes. And if you go through the process, you know, you set a goal and then you pick your priorities. And there's a list in the book. And if you follow the process, it's in chapter 1 or chapter 16. You know, you're actually picking the priorities for a given situation. They're different in value than values, because priorities change depending on what you're focused on. You know, if you're focused on coming into a new school situation and finding out what's working before you say you're going to change everything, which generally doesn't happen, which is why it's the first story in the book of a leader who really listens before he makes changes. You know, that's a very different goal. So you're going to do that. You're going to have different priorities. And then you've got to record why it's so important and how you're going to know you're making progress. So my clients actually end up with this real-time tiny card that has their three priorities, why they're so important, which is making you 90% more likely to reach that goal, and in a sentence, how am I going to know if I'm making progress? And I just got an email from one of my students saying, well, that was a brutal exercise in self-awareness as they started the process of just setting the goal. That's what leadership development is all about, is really get into what do I do well and how are my strengths going to blindside me if I'm not careful? How's my mindset going to blindside me? But that's what the book is. You know, if you do the whole process, which takes time, that's where you get.
Yeah, well, I love the resources that are included with the book, and I put a link in the chat to the Solution Tree website where those resources can be downloaded. And there's a reference in the text as well. But yeah, I think that's a great point, that it's not people who don't have skills or strengths or strong values that get blindsided. And that was something that I saw play out over and over again when I was a principal in Seattle. It was the people who had the clearest, strongest vision, a very strong skill set in a particular area, and yet they would get taken down by their failure to see the polarity that was at work and the you know, the wisdom in the resistance, what they framed as resistance that they were not listening to. You know, that's the kind of thing that often just really blindsides people. So an excellent frame for a leadership development program. All right. So we are at the end of our time here. Jane, thank you so much for engaging with us. I know we've spoken many times in the past, and I really appreciate your time today. If a leader is interested in getting in touch with you, I know you said you've been doing executive coaching since you were 9 years old, but if they're interested in working with you, or at least having a conversation about potentially working together, or just finding more about your dozens of other books and other work, where's the best place for them to find you online?
JaneKesey.com, and you know, you can just look at the webinar. It's JaneKesey.com, and you can contact me through there. You know, I'll also be at Learning Forward doing a session on our Women in Leadership book, and I'm always open to finding people for coffee breaks and breakfasts and lunches and dinners at Learning Forward and having deeper conversations, because that's what makes the conference fun. So,
absolutely. St. Louis in December, right?
Right. Right.
All right. I will see you there. I'll have to check and see if our sessions may overlap a little bit. I'll have to double check, but I think I registered for yours. So is yours Monday?
Right. And I know
okay,
I
think mine's Tuesday.
I think you're right. Yeah. Oh, no.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
But okay. We'll definitely catch up. And anyone who will be at Learning Forward, I know we have several people from Illinois on this call, so you can get down to St. Louis. It's not that far. Thank you so much, Jane. Look forward to seeing you at Learning Forward, and very much appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Yep, let's map another polarity down there together. Thank you.
Will do. All right. Thanks, everybody.